Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Filmcast, a podcast about movies. I'm David Chen, and I need an angel to protect me from boring podcasts. Joining me today is Devendra Hardawar.
I can't help but think about Aziz Ansari's good fortune these days.
And Jeff Cannata.
If there really is an angel in charge of texting while driving, they're doing a terrible job.
Those are, of course, all vague and oblique references to the fact that today on the podcast, we're going to be reviewing Aziz Ansari's newest film, Good Fortune. Folks, I do want to mention there has been ongoing construction right outside my window. And so there's a cement truck mixing stuff and the noise is really unbearable. So deepest apologies if you hear anything about in the background. We'll try to minimize that for you. But we are here today because we got a lot of what we've been watching to discuss, some really great stuff here. Plus, of course, some weekly plugs and then our review of Good Fortune. But first, let's talk about some emails at slashfilmcast@gmail.com. A couple weeks ago, Jeff Cannata and I talked about how it's difficult when you are a fan of something, like, and we've discussed this in the past, it's not the first time, that there's no real cadence for telling them that you appreciate their work. You know what I mean? Like, if you've listened to a podcast or watched a show or whatever for 10 years, you know, you might write them an email once, but you're not going to keep writing them every week. That doesn't make sense. I mean, some people keep writing, but, you know, most people won't keep writing. And so we put the call out. We're like, hey, if there's anything nice you have to say, feel free to say it to us. Got several responses.
Wow. You guys are just like over there farming for, that's called aura farming.
Aura farming. For the kids. Right. That's what it is.
Yeah.
Aura farming for the Riz. As they say.
For the Riz, yeah.
Okay, so this one comes in from David B. David writes into slashfilmcast@gmail.com. I'm about to get divorced from my wife and partner of 7 years. This completely unforeseen event has both devastated me and also granted me an opportunity, the time to review one of your episodes. I can't think of a better use for my newfound bachelorhood. My friends and family have told me I should focus on getting my affairs in order. But how can I when there's an episode of the Filmcast drifting out there in the ether, waiting to be reviewed and criticized? I need to be honest, though. This review is just an excuse to heap praise upon three of my favorite internet strangers. I was inspired by the listener who wrote in describing their experience listening to your review of him and how it helped them through tough times. You've done the same for me more times than I can remember. Over the years, I've shared anecdotes, jokes, and slash film court asides from episodes with my soon-to-be ex-wife. For the longest time, if we ever heard some bad news, one of us would look at the other and say, "That's real rough, Jeff." We also only ever referred to the Max streaming service.
Why was that the catchphrase?
As yeah. HBO Max, the one to watch for HBO Max. I often tell my wife that Dave is my spirit animal because his opinions are always correct, just like mine.
Oh, I wonder why we read this email on the show.
Though I won't share those times with her anymore, your podcast continues to bring me comfort and joy. Episode 845 reminded me that you might not hear that enough. Might be easy to assume you're just another group of humans shouting into the void, but I assure you the void is listening and heartened by the sound of your voices. Thank you for everything. Please keep going. End quote. Comes in from David. I just like the idea that "That's rough, Jeff" is, or "That's real rough, Jeff" might be a catchphrase that makes its way out into the world organically.
That's great.
Delivered after delightful. a particularly cringe or painful statement. I think we should all start using "That's rough, Jeff" more often. Okay. Anyway.
Thank you for that email. It was lovely. Lovely sentiment. And sorry that you're going through a rough time right now.
Indeed. Yeah,
there are many
indeed.
Jokes we could make, which we're not going to make.
There are right many, now. Yeah. I mean, yeah. I guess the only thing I will say about it is I hope the podcast did not serve as any kind of accelerant in that equation.
I could see how that could be the case. I could see how
absolutely
in divorce court, specific lines, specific
exhibit like, A.
Exhibit A. This man forced me to listen to this podcast in the car for 5 years.
Then they reviewed Bring Her Back and I couldn't take it anymore.
I just want to say if it did hurt at all, let me just tell you guys, it's not worth it. It's not worth it. The podcast is not worth it. So
it's where you and I disagree, Dave.
Yeah, indeed. Indeed. All right. Here's another similarly personal email that comes from Rod writing into slashfilmcast@gmail.com. Rod writes in, "I found you in COVID on recommendation from a friend. I've been a patron for some time now, and I always look forward to the new episodes and After Darks." And here, I'm just going to say, this is David Chen speaking now. I'm going to anonymize some of the details here because some of this is a little personal. But Rod writes, "I recently passed out at customs and split my head open.
Yeesh.
after going home a day early from a trip to an event in New York with clients because of the incredible amount of pain I woke up in. In the hospital, they discovered I was septic and had necrotizing fasciitis. Oof. Long story short, I came out alive and I'm now healing in my bed slowly. I look forward to your shows the most. There is just something about the group dynamic, your respect for the art, not to mention your political views. I really appreciate your shows. I've been tasked with out of bed time as the bacteria slowly ate through my colon and down my butt cheek, so I cannot be lying down all the time in order to facilitate blood flow for healing and to help with the symptoms of the brain bleed I received when I passed out in customs. So my wife and I do jigsaw puzzles. Listening to your shows while doing jigsaw puzzles is truly enjoyable, even when the pain starts throbbing. You guys keep me entertained. I just want to say, keep it up. You really help. Finally, if you haven't seen The Ballad of Wallace Island, please do so now. It's a movie made for Jeff. It's an incredibly moving and touching film that hasn't been seen enough. Everyone who I have shown it to has loved it and cried watching it. It is a fantastic film. End quote. Sorry, people That's seem lovely. To be having, so, you know, some of our listeners seem to be having some troubles lately, and we're sorry for that. We're glad that the podcast can be a source of comfort during these challenging times. Indeed. And also, sorry, go ahead, Jeff.
I said indeed.
Indeed. Yeah. Yeah. And very, also, very touching.
Yeah. Yeah, go ahead, Devendra. Go ahead.
I do want to say, every one of these things you're reading is, there's just so much ammo. There's just so much ammo in these letters that... Listeners, I love you. I love you. Butt bacteria?
Yeah. I mean,
there's so many
impressive
things.
Impressive amount of detail.
We're just like restraining ourselves right now.
Yes.
I would say if anybody is not enjoying the show, maybe try suffering a massive brain injury. And then maybe you'll enjoy it more.
I think that's what made him a bigger fan of the show. You know, before he was just a sort of a fan. Now, like, yeah, Willie. But no, that's a lovely letter.
Yeah, yes. we certainly wish you a speedy recovery. And my goodness. But I love the notion of sitting there doing jigsaw puzzles, listening to the show. That just seems so wholesome and lovely.
It seems lovely.
I agree. That was a thing during COVID. Do you guys do jigsaw puzzles during COVID? My wife and I did a couple of jigsaw puzzles during COVID. I think she finds that soothing. Do you know what I mean? To sit around and do the jigsaw puzzle. It's not really my thing, but it's like, many people find it a relaxing activity.
Yeah. It depends on how your brain is just like accepting of that stuff. Like I took my kids to Legoland this weekend. I was never a big Lego guy. I like to put things together. My daughter is big into it. I realized when you have a big old tub of Legos, you have to sift through to find individual parts and stuff. Does not relax me. It's the opposite. It's like, oh man, this is very annoying and frustrating. But yes, I would love to do more jigsaw puzzles. Yeah.
Have you guys heard of this Ballad of Wallace Island movie?
No.
This is a recommendation directly for Jeff Cannata in this one. I have received multiple recommendations for Ballad of Wallace Island. So I'm actually taking a huge flight today and I am going to download Ballad of Wallace Island. Apparently it's available on Prime Video, so you can watch it there. And I will watch it. And Jeff, perhaps you can consider adding it to your list for next week. Maybe we can talk about it, but I will try to check it out.
Before your huge flight, by the way, make sure that device is checked in for whatever service you have downloaded an offline file to, because they're very stupid, because you can download offline files and be like, oh, you didn't sign on today, so you can't watch this offline file. Sorry, buddy. So that's a thing.
You've signed in my
children's lives, by
yes,
the way.
Launch the streaming app on that device while you're online before you get on the plane. Do it that day. So it authenticates like, hey,
you're here.
And this offline file is good, because there are times where that doesn't work.
Can't watch it. Sorry.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Got it. I don't know about you guys, but this is what usually happens. I've said this several times before on Patreon or whatever, but I usually spend, I'm going to say, an hour downloading meticulously. Like, I'm like a freaking sommelier of streaming services. I'm like, I have a comedy and I have a romance and I have a drama. And I'm like curating this entire opus of I'm going to say somewhere on the order of like 50 hours of entertainment, right? Yeah, literally get on the plane. Yeah, go ahead, Jeff.
There's no optimism like big long flight optimism. You know what I'm saying?
Beach vacation optimism.
Get on the plane. I spend 5 hours watching episodes of Hot Ones and then I pass out. You know, that's kind of what.
Yeah, that's how I do. I got a book. I got a project probably. I can write something. I got stuff to watch. I got a Steam Deck. I got Switch 2.
Oh, yeah. I bought like 5 games on Switch 2. I'm like, maybe I'm going to play.
And you know what happens? Final Fantasy Tactics.
Nothing.
Yeah.
Nothing.
Sleep. That's what happens.
Sleep happens.
Plane takes off. My head falls to the side and I'm out.
You know, in the past, we have talked about the concept of raw dogging a flight where you get on a flight and you no book, no computer, no iPad, no phone. Just stare at the seat in front of you for the entire flight.
Yes.
I saw something even more intense than that recently, which was I saw a video, like a TikTok of somebody sitting outside on a chair, like in the yard. And just saying they were raw dogging reality, like looking at nothing but air, you know.
That's not more intensive.
You're right. But the dedication.
That's
the idea is they're trying to preserve their attention span. Right?
We used to call that mindfulness. Like the going good thing about raw dogging on planes, it's because that's the only place you can go where the annoyances of reality cannot really touch you. Like unless you sign into the online Wi-Fi or whatever, you're free. All obligations from people, phone calls, texts, notifications, you're free in the air. So that's why people are raw dogging. It's really the only chance you have to be free from modern life, weirdly enough.
Yeah. You know what a park bench is?
What is it, Jeff? Mm-hmm.
That.
Okay. Sorry, I thought there was a punchline
more to it. There's more to it. Yeah. Something I'll also mention, depending on where you're going, sometimes it's really, I kind of anticipate like looking at what the in-flight menu option of movies are, especially if like you're going to other countries.
Yeah. Sometimes you'll have stuff in theaters. You'll have in theaters stuff.
Or foreign language films that aren't released in the US yet, but have licensing for the airplane. That's always exciting. Yeah.
Very exciting. Well, anyway. Stay tuned for more details about what that journey is going to be all about. But I just want to say thank you so much to all the people who wrote in lovely emails at slashfilmcast@gmail.com. That's not all of them. That's just a couple, but we really appreciate it. And it's always great to hear that the show is a meaningful part of people's lives. And in this case, people recovering from really challenging situations, that does mean a lot.
It means we're a safe space, right? That people are turning to at their lowest moments. So that's a good sign. Mm-hmm. That's a good sign. Mm-hmm. To that question, though, because I think this was asked when I was away,
it's funny,
right?
because we're recording the show at our lowest moments in our lives. And then people are listening to it at the lowest moment of life. So it's like,
we are arriving.
That's why they feel so sympathetic.
We all found each other. Yeah. We all
are arriving at our lowest moments in real time.
Yeah, in real
time
as we record the podcast. That's right.
But for people you follow, people you like, life changes for them. Like there are big moments sometimes where you can just reach out and be like, hey, I've been following your work for a while. I really like what you're doing. Keep it up. And people often appreciate that. So I've seen that, like, people I know who are moving to different places or, you know, starting different jobs, a little note of kindness is always, always appreciated.
Indeed. Now who's aura farming, Devendra? Anyway, I totally agree, though. That's very...
I'm not asking for aura. I'm giving tips on how to spread the aura, you know?
That's basically all we were doing as well. Anyway, thank you so much for the emails. slashfilmcast@gmail.com. Let's take a break for a sponsor. We'll be back with more and what we've been watching right after this.
This episode of the Filmcast is brought to you by Mood. Hey, I bet you didn't know that there is an online cannabis company that ships federally legal THC right to your door. And they found a way to combine THC with carefully selected functional ingredients to target nearly every mood and health concern you can think of. I'm talking about Mood, mood.com, and their incredible line of functional gummies. And you can get 20% off your first order at mood.com with our promo code, FILMCAST. Forget one-size-fits-all supplements that only get you high. Mood's functional gummies are optimized to kick in as little as 15 minutes and take you to the mood that you're looking for. Whether that's mind magic gummies for deep work and creativity, PMS support to ease cramps and balance mood swings, or their sexual euphoria gummies to help you get ready for action and turn every touch into a full body experience. Listen, you can find gummies to just get you high pretty much anywhere these days, but Mood's functional gummies combine premium, federally legal THC with targeted botanicals to help you get into the perfect mood, usually in as little as 15 minutes. And everything ships discreetly right to your door. No dispensary lines, no awkward conversations, just better days and nights delivered right to your doorstep. Best of all, not only is every Mood product backed by a 100-day satisfaction guarantee, but as I mentioned before, listeners of the Filmcast get 20% off their first order with code FILMCAST. So, head over to Mood.com right now, find the functional gummy that matches exactly what you're looking for, and let Mood help you discover your perfect mood. And don't forget to use our promo code FILMCAST, F-I-L-M-C-A-S-T, when you check out to save 20% off your first order.
Jeff Cannata, my last week has been absolutely nuts. And so as a result, I was not able to join you in spirit in watching the new Bruce Springsteen biopic Deliver Me From Nowhere. But you had a chance to see this movie. What do you think?
Springsteen Deliver Me From Nowhere. Yes. I think the Springsteen colon was added so that people would not be confused.
Not only that, Jeff, but when I'm watching like social ads on Instagram or TikTok, they just call it Springsteen. They don't even, they cut out. It's like, they don't even say the subtitle, which by the way, I believe is the name of the book that it's based on.
That's right.
Right, so they just say, you know, you'll see Jeremy Allen White, and I just want to write a song, and then it's like Springsteen in theaters now, and it's like, oh wow, they don't even give a shit about the subtitle.
First announced it was just called Deliver Me From Nowhere. You didn't see Springsteen anywhere on it, and I think now that has evolved.
It's flipped now. It's just Springsteen now.
You got to know
probably a wise choice.
There. You got to know there was some dude in an office somewhere, and it was like, can't we just call it Born to Run? Anybody? Hello,
wasn't that already a movie? Like, yeah. I feel like somebody used that title. But I keep hearing the title, Deliver Me From Nowhere. Springsteen does not register on any of my radar. So it's like, oh, that's some foreign film, right? That's coming. that sounds like a nice European
You are proof of why they did the whole thing.
Exactly.
Down.
So I'm it saying, does yes, not have, you are thank the problem. Thank you for adding Springsteen there.
It does not have, it could have been, you know, Dancing in the Dark. It could have, there's a million Springsteen titles that would have evoked Springsteen. Yes. And they did not choose any of those.
But they chose the one that
based on this novel.
Yeah.
And I'm actually pretty sad that Dave didn't find the time to squeak this one in, because I'm very curious what you would have thought of this movie, because I think it pretty effectively eschews the entire template that you bristle at with regard to these, you know, kinds of musical biopics. It's much more similar to a I mean, it's not all the way this way, but it's much more similar to the Steve Jobs movie in that it is a very narrow slice that sort of dug deep. And yes,
love it.
We get lots of flashbacks to him as a kid, but it's, you know, it's the different template. It's the template of my entire life led me up to this song, you know. But it's done.
I think you mean to say Dewey Cox needs to think about his entire life before he plays.
I think that the point that this movie is making is that this one particular album, i.e. the Nebraska album, what is the one that sort of became the most personal, like he opened up a much deeper level of sort of personal expression. And he wasn't just making these really iconic rock songs. He was trying to do something that was a departure from what he had become known for. And then right after that, he does Born in the USA and becomes this mega star. But this, the movie takes place in this narrow window where he writes, Nebraska, and sort of, you know, there's some pushback from the record label, like this is I want hits, these aren't hits, but like he wants to make Nebraska and not you know, not put himself on the cover, not put his face on the cover, not do any tour to support it, not do any pressure, sort of let it speak for himself. And it has this very intense artistic authorship that he wants to maintain. And so in that sense, I think it very much isn't the movie that you worried it would be. But for my money, I wish it was a little bit more the movie you worried it would be. I think it's an interesting movie. I liked it. I did not love it. And I think Jeremy Allen White is you know, really good as Springsteen. His performance, there's some performing stuff that he does that is, you know, really captures the intensity, the energy of a young 1980s Bruce Springsteen. But what is entirely missing here that I would have liked more of is, you know, more of Springsteen's relationship to the world. And like, there's no, if you're looking for any insight into the E Street Band, it is entirely absent in this movie. Completely. Like they are, they show up, they're not named. They just, the camera kind of passes them as they're performing. Like there's no insight into his process in that sense at all. It, you know, it's him writing one very particular album and sort of dealing with his childhood and his father, really. It's a movie about his relationship to his father. And the fact that this one album really is channeled through that relationship. And I think it's good. It's fine. I did not like it as much as the Dylan movie, frankly, which I know you hated. But I think it's fine. I think it's interesting. And I think, you know, it has some cool Springsteen to it. You get a performance from Jeremy Strong playing John Landau. But you don't really get much of the other parts of his life here. And there's no explanation as to, you know, the how he kind of broke and, you know, what the origin of him kind of coming up. None of that. We get like him as a 7-year-old and then him in 1982. And those are the two time periods that this movie deals with exclusively. Right. So you're not getting like the whole arc of his life. You're not getting his sort of origin story. You're getting his relationship with his dad at 7 and then Nebraska in 1982. So I don't know. I yearned for more, frankly. And, you know, the movie's not short, but it's just hyper-focused on this one period of his life. And I want to mention something from the end credits. So if you're concerned about a spoiler, I don't think this spoils the movie in any way, but if you're concerned about spoilers for the end title card of the movie, skip ahead 30 seconds. But the end title card says, and Bruce Springsteen continued to struggle with depression. And I was like, oh, is that what this movie was about? Oh, that's what we were talking about this whole time? Oh, that was not clear to me at all. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously he was dealing with the emotional fallout of his abusive dad and his, you know, rough childhood.
Right,
but
right.
Like the movie like just straight out says that. And I go, oh, I think maybe it's me not recognizing that. But I think there is, if that's what we were talking about the whole time, I think there's something missing here. Cause I did not.
That's a huge bummer when you get to the end of a movie and then you get to the text and then the text reveals what the movie thought it was being the whole time.
Right.
And then exactly. It lowers your estimation of the movie, you know, yes. Like that. That's yes. Always.
I was like, I enjoyed this, but I right. did not get that from, yes. it, you know,
yes.
Like that he was, yes. you know, I don't know. It's like, it's a bummer because retroactively I'm like, okay, I see what they're talking about, but it did not land the way I think it thought it was landing. And so anyway, I thought it was fine. I thought it was fine. And I wanted to be more enthusiastic about it because of, you know, because the central figure is somebody that I really admire and want to know more about, frankly. And he seems like an interesting, you know, fascinating human being. And we just get such a narrow view of this one little moment. I don't think it's particularly revelatory.
Sorry to hear that, Jeff, but ironically, everything you've said has made me want to see this movie more.
Yeah, that's why I'm very curious what you would think of it, because this isn't the kind of movie that you tend to not like. And I don't know, Devendra, I don't know, are you interested in this at all?
No.
Fair.
Honestly,
I like his music. I don't care for the biopic aspect, you know. Let me just enjoy the songs.
Honestly, the only reason I would check it out is for you, Jeff, but that's not a bad reason to do something. So
Jeff recommendation, that's a good one. It sounds more intriguing than whatever they're doing, the four Beatles movies. We're getting more Beatles stuff.
That'll be interesting. That's so interesting.
Interesting, but for people who are not as interested in those people that we keep hearing about, it's gonna be a rough time.
It's going to be a dark time on the podcast. It's
literally all people.
We need to crank out four reviews of Beatles movies in a couple of years. So look forward to that. The movie is Springsteen Deliver Me From Nowhere. It's available right now in theaters. Devendra Hardwar and I had a chance to check out Catherine Bigelow's latest film, House of Dynamite, which is streaming right now.
It's been so long since a Catherine Bigelow
movie. It's been like 7 years.
Seven years since Detroit. Yeah.
In order to discuss this movie, we need to discuss the basic structure of the movie. So if you don't want to, and the premise of the movie. So if you don't want to know those things, tune out. But here's the basic premise of the movie I'm reading from online. When a single unattributed missile is launched at the United States, a race begins to determine who is responsible and how to respond, end quote.
Mm-hmm.
And I will just say that for the first, so what happens in this movie is the first 30, 35 minutes or so shows you what happens when this missile is launched and how like the various organs of the United States military and government respond to it.
But it's the first response, the first, the people who
the initial responders, as it were,
dealing with it. Yeah.
And then the movie then rewinds and plays back the same events from a different perspective.
That's so cool.
And you go deeper and deeper and deeper to like generals and then to top level. What will the president do about this?
That sounds awesome to me.
It sounds awesome, doesn't it, Jeff?
It sounds awesome.
Yeah.
It sounds awesome. I mean, look, I have two big overarching thoughts about this. Number one, I really appreciate what this movie's trying to do, which is I read Annie Jacobson's book, Nuclear War, A Scenario. It's excellent.
Yeah.
And it kind of...
That was some, good time reading for that book, but yes.
Oh, yeah. I mean, so essentially what happens in that book, which I believe has been optioned by Denis Villeneuve. I don't... now that this movie, House of Dynamite, exists, I don't see how they would make that movie, honestly. Like, it would be like a Deep Impact Armageddon situation
type deal.
So I don't know how they're going to do that. Anyway, but point being, in reality, if, let's say, Russia or North Korea were to launch a nuclear missile at the United States, it would take approximately 30 minutes for it to hit somewhere in the continental United States.
Mm-hmm.
And this book, and also the movie, this book, Nuclear War Scenario, and also the movie House of Dynamite, shows you virtually in real time what would happen in that case, in that situation.
With faces you recognize, like Rebecca Ferguson and Jared Harris, Tracy Letts. Yeah.
And Tracy Letts is awesome. And the short version of the story is you want very smart, capable, calm, cool, collected, measured people in charge. That is one of the big lessons that you take away from the book and the movie is like, hey, these people who are like making life or death decisions for billions of people, they need to be smart and they need to be good at their jobs in order for this to even have a chance of going okay.
But I feel basically, you've made a terrible mistake in that case.
Yeah.
Really?
I mean, it's just dawning on me now, but it does seem.
Yeah, think about it, Jeff.
It does seem like we made a terrible miscalculation.
You know, first of all, Jeff, I agree. But secondly, I think that I don't want to get too much into this, but like, I honestly think, in my opinion, when people were casting their votes, or when people cast their votes in general, I don't think they think about this situation. Like, I don't think they're I don't think they're thinking about this. And what I appreciate about the movie House of Dynamite is it puts this situation at the forefront of people's minds. It helps you to imagine what would the people in charge of our government do if this happened. And like,
this is what it looks like when semi-competent people are in positions of power and control in this movie.
Yeah, you know, and so, I guess honestly, that's one of the big flaws of the film is it has a kind of, like, this movie could have been made in 2010 or 2012, right? Mm-hmm. And you would not need to change it. Like, nothing in the movie really acknowledges our current reality in any way. So, like, that's just one aspect of the movie.
It doesn't have to because the nuclear bombs don't care. It doesn't care who's in power,
fair,
right?
Like, but nothing acknowledges our current political reality. Is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
It's like this dream, like Sorkin West Wing fever dream from like 10 years ago. Like, it's not a realistic.
It feels like an Obama era movie. Actually,
it's an Obama era movie. It doesn't acknowledge anything that's going on. Okay, so that's my point number one. My point number two is, and this is a common complaint I've seen: not enough insight is added by repeating the story additional times. In general, if you show like Rashomon, right? Like if you watch Rashomon, the prototypical example, those stories are vastly different. Like each because time they about, retell the story.
That's about their memories of a thing, not the direct timeline.
Yeah.
Hey, this is what happened from this perspective.
But like in my opinion, not enough insight is gained from repeating the story. And as a result, by the end, the thing has completely lost all momentum.
Yeah.
And it feels honestly like a pretty big waste of time to me.
It's it feels like a kind of a mess is the thing. Like I want to say ultimately like there's process stuff in this movie that I think is really cool. Catherine Bigelow, the queen of like doing people at keyboards, doing important stuff, taking phone calls, but also like military stuff happening. Like she is such a kinetic filmmaker that even people doing boring stuff on screens is like very interesting, very compelling.
And, I agree.
I want more of this. But the problem with this movie is that the script is by Mr. Noah Oppenheim. And you guys did not see the last thing he did, which was the Robert De Niro. This movie is like, what if a nuclear bomb, what if nuclear rocket hits the U.S.? His other show on Netflix, what if a cyber attack destroys U.S. economy, you know, and U.S. infrastructure? Very similar, actually, because it's also process heavy and kind of nerdy. And in that one, Robert De Niro is the only person who can save us from this because he's a former president, yada, yada. Dude gets a little too like up his own butt, I think, about the perspective and not like really making us care about these characters or doing anything interesting with those different perspectives. Because the tension of like, oh my God, there's a bomb going off. Early responders like, yes, we're going to try to stop this. There's tension there, right? You repeat that three times, that tension is lost. You kind of have a sense of like what's going to happen. Yeah. So there is no tension here. There, weirdly enough, it seems like this could have actually been a pretty decent 5 or 6 episode Netflix like series where you could really like spend time in those perspectives and maybe actually build up something. I think the big criticism with this movie is that you don't get any answers. Like this is strictly about this scenario. Missile appears. What do you do? And for 2.5 hours, everyone's like, oh shit, oh shit, oh shit.
Yeah, well, let's not talk about how the movie ends.
I'm not going to say, I'm just saying,
how the movie ends.
It just ends.
I think we can safely say that Devendra and I found the movie very unsatisfying, okay? And we can
leave
it at
that.
For many reasons. And you're talking about Zero Day, right? The Robert De Niro Netflix movie. Zero Day is the name of the show.
Which nobody saw, but is basically the same thing. And I feel like it's sort of like we're getting research thrown at us, right? And not like narrative, not like story or characters. And Bigelow has, since Hurt Locker, right? Hurt Locker and Zero Dark Thirty, it felt like she was combining her action movie talents with like telling important stories, but also doing it, making political thrillers that felt kinetic and interesting, but also like had a bigger message and was saying something more about the world. I don't, other than the fact that, hey, it'd be pretty bad if somebody did this. It sure would be bad.
Jeff, did you know if somebody launched a potential warhead at the United States, that would be bad? I don't
know
if
real bad.
Did you know that?
Just realizing it now, but man.
Yeah.
Well, would you like to watch a 2-hour movie that attests to the same thing?
2.5-hour movie. the other thing about this movie, though, is that as I started watching it, I was like, oh, we're not going to see seeing a fully intact White House. It's now a thing of the past.
Yeah, the movies are wrong. All the movies are inaccurate. We've lost the verisimilitude on the movies.
It's not about being.
Good thing Aaron Sorkin didn't make The East Wing. You know what I'm saying?
Because sure
then the movie would have aged. The show would have aged really poorly.
You have to change the title to The Ballroom.
But it was sort of like that moment where it's like, oh, this thing that happened that nobody expected this week that basically made history. I was like, oh, kind of 9/11 into ourselves, didn't we? Because it's like watching things before 9/11 is like, oh, the Twin Towers are there. That's weird. That's a different world we were living in. Now seeing anything with a fully intact White House is like, that's a whole different world. That was just before last week.
Well, it's a good thing people are really upset about it and all the lawmakers are talking about it all the time, you know?
Yeah, it's a good thing.
It's a good thing people are making their objections known publicly and repeatedly. But Jeff, go ahead. What were you going
to
say?
I don't need to pile on.
This movie comes at a really inopportune time, I'd say, for many reasons. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that they probably did not anticipate that the current
the White House being destroyed
administration would be in power when this movie came out. That is my
probably
guess.
Probably didn't. Yeah.
As when they're
yeah.
making this movie, that is what my guess is. Devendra, do we want to do a spoiler thing in the After Dark on this? What do you think?
If you want, yeah. And Jeff, if you end up watching it, yeah. But we could just talk about spoilers because it's weird. Yeah. This is a weird movie. This is not just like a misfire. This is choices were made that are kind of baffling about this movie.
So we will, during this week's After Dark, we will do a little 5-minute section where we talk about spoilers for House of Dynamite because, you know, Kathryn Bigelow, previous director of Best Picture winner Hurt Locker, you know, like obviously one of the great action directors of our time, worth discussing further.
I want her to make more stuff is the thing. Like all the directors who were big in the 80s and 90s are like now hustling to make as much shit as they can. The ones who are still in power or still like producing stuff, they're rushing to make stuff while they can. And I really wish she didn't have to spend like 7-8 years waiting for her next project, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I will say I can't help but feel a little bit disappointed by this in a variety of ways. First of all, I don't like the movie, but secondly, even putting that aside, it's kind of a bunch of people sitting in rooms talking and, you know, it feels like a weird application of Kathryn Bigelow's talents because she is a supremely talented action filmmaker. Right. So it's like if she can make that kind of movie, she should, in my opinion. But hey, you know, maybe she really wanted to. I mean, she also seems somebody that's really guided by her passions and somebody who like has specific stories that she wants to tell.
Yeah. She wants to tell big, important stories. That's right.
Regardless of how popular they'll be or even I would argue, regardless of how entertaining they'll be.
Yeah. Detroit was not an entertaining movie.
Yeah, Detroit
not
an entertaining movie.
That came well before.
This movie, I would say, is not a particularly entertaining movie, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
But again, I really appreciate what the movie's trying to do. I think it's an important, like, this is the number one movie on Netflix as we're recording this right now. So, like, millions of people are watching it. I think it's actually great that millions of people know. So, like, in general, I support what the movie is trying to do. Like, I'm not, like, anti this movie. I'm not saying you shouldn't watch it. I just didn't particularly enjoy the movie that much. And also, I think, you know, Devendra, something you haven't talked about, and we can talk about this more in our After Dark spoilers, is some of the dialogue is actually really bad.
It's real bad.
It's like very melodramatic. It's very maudlin. It's kind of like the Vince Gilligan school of two brothers sitting across from each other and like, wow, we sure have been brothers for a long time. Like that kind of level of, why are you saying this? You should at least have some sense of what you're talking about. Like there's no way you would actually be talking like this in real life. Kind of very stilted
as brothers who've been estranged for 3 years. It makes me wonder what you want for lunch.
Imagine that level, but for talking about our nuclear attack countermeasures, basically.
We're also just random scenes involving the vice president's daughter or something. Just like things happen. It's wild what happens in this movie.
Things happen. Yeah. Things happen. So anyway, yes, we can talk more about this in the After Dark. But yeah, Devendra, would you recommend this overall? Like, I'm not.
I would
hearing...
say if you like. Here's the thing: if you are a Bigelow head like myself, if you like the whole thing of like smart people doing things that they've been trained for and seeing that grit and seeing like, okay, I've been prepping for this, that is on display in this movie, but maybe for about half of it. And the other half is very confusing narratively in terms of like how it's structured and what it's doing. And quite honestly, where it ends. Because I'm trying to be like, what are we taking away from this?
I have a very clear sense of that, but we can't talk about that, but like, but so the way the movie ends makes clear what the movie's trying to do. So I get that. And also I am annoyed by what the movie's trying to
deeply
do.
Deeply unsatisfying.
So it's like both things can be true. The only other thing I want to add is I understand why they did it this way, which is like, it takes about 30 minutes for the missile to reach the United States. So it's like, how cool would it be to do a movie in real time, and then, then that's only a 30-minute movie. So then it's like,
we had a mechanism for telling stories between 30 and 45 minutes from different perspectives, in different, like, with different narrative containers.
Yeah,
we call them like a container for 45 minutes of
like
narrative.
Like episodic containers. I wish there was a word, maybe episodes. You could think of them as. But
truly baffling.
So I understand why they did it though, because it's like, oh, tell it in real time. That's so cool. And then, but then, how do you feel the whole movie? Oh, just do it again, but from a different perspective. I get it.
Yeah,
but it's just not illuminating enough.
The 24 writers are looking at this, and being like, huh? Not so easy, is it? Is it?
Okay, I do want to defend the movie. Mm-hmm. As we close off our conversation here, I do want to defend the movie in one respect, which is a lot of people have said that this is similar to 24, because 24 was always a ticking time bomb scenario.
Yeah, and they see
this as a kind of like a conservative fantasy.
This is about, just real life.
Yeah, I agree with you, Devin. Like, the movie is extremely US centric. Mm-hmm. It is extremely barely anyone outside of the US exists in this movie. But I don't think
they exist as threat objects, right? This is
sure. Yeah, that's right.
This is the worst thing that can happen to this country. Everyone in power is like, oh shit. Like, what do we do? What do we do next? And I really like Idris Elba in this, because he is a president who's just tired. He's just dead. Yeah, he's like, what?
That's his one.
I got a basketball thing to do. What's next on my schedule? Oh, nuclear rocket headed right to us. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Great.
But I do want to defend the movie. Like, people are saying, yeah, this is like a 24 conservative fantasy. And I don't actually agree with that. I think this is actually what would happen in real life. Like, it doesn't matter if it's conservative or liberal. Like, this would happen in real life. Some version similar to this would happen in real life.
If it were more heightened, you know, if this was like a 90s political thriller where like, oh, they don't even name who it could be from. There's things we don't know.
Right.
It's just like threat. Threat exists. Yeah. People respond to threat like white blood cells in your bloodstream, when you're getting sick. Like, that's, you're seeing the process.
Yeah.
And that, there are cool things to that. So if you like Catherine Bigelow stuff, it is worth watching.
Yeah.
Just don't expect too much.
I agree. I'm a diehard Catherine Bigelow fan, so I'm going to watch whatever she does. And I think that, therefore, if you're a Catherine Bigelow fan, you should watch this as well. And also, I love the first, I thought the first 40
Rebecca
minutes
Ferguson.
Were great.
Rebecca Ferguson staring at like big screens, projected screens, furrowing her brow. That's cinema.
I thought the first 30, 40 minutes was like, this is awesome. This is great. And then, and that's where the movie should have ended. But anyway, okay.
I think a nuclear missile could have hit us in the time you guys were talking about that movie.
probably, Jeff. And now we know exactly what will happen should that occur.
Yeah. I'm sorry to hear you say that, Jeff, because I thought our conversation about this was riveting and went by super fast.
I don't need to watch this in like the first 2 minutes. But, yeah.
Next week we'll hear Jeff's perspective.
Not if you're a big ahead, Jeff.
Yeah.
Anyway.
We'll hear Jeff's perspective of hearing our review next week. We'll see how entertaining that
Imagine
is.
Imagine if you got to hear your perspective of hearing our review, Jeff. That's what this movie is like.
Yeah.
Okay. The movie is House of Dynamite. It is streaming right now on Netflix. And those are our thoughts on it. Let's take a break for a sponsor. We'll be back with more what we've been watching right after this. Jeff Cannata, hit us up with something you've been watching this week.
Checked out a new animated kids film that is fit for the season. I believe it's hitting theaters as we speak. It's called Stitchhead. This is a 3D animated story based on children's books. These are not children's books I'm familiar with. I don't know if it's a single book or a series of books. I think it's a series, but... It is a riff on the Frankenstein monster story, in that there is a mad scientist who lives in a giant castle called Grotesque or something like it's. It's a cute like mispronunciation of grotesque, which is very clever.
That's cool. That's cool.
And this scientist does not just make one Frankenstein's monster. No. They make numerous monsters. And the first of them, though, is Stitchhead, a little boy with stitches in his head. And this story is about the monsters being scared of people, because they're perpetually scared of an angry mob storming the castle, because evidently, I guess they've read Frankenstein. I don't know. That's weird that they would be worried about that.
This is also the plot of Hotel Transylvania. So,
oh, really?
Which I know. Funny. I'm now an expert in Hotel Transylvania. But, you know, yeah.
I've never seen Hotel Transylvania.
Yeah, very similar. It's all the monsters are terrified of the humans coming to get them.
Yeah, so that's the deal here. And the humans are terrified of the monsters. And in between those is an opportunist who is a sort of P.T. Barnum-esque circus guy. What's the word I was looking for? Ringleader, I guess. Anyway, he comes to town, finds out that there's monsters stuck in this castle, wants to use the monster as a main attraction, and so talks Stitchhead into leaving the castle because he says everyone will love you. And then he uses Stitchhead as a circus freak to make lots of money. And there's some musings, some theming about fame and the sort of tenuous nature of fame, the hollow nature of fame, the fact that the love, quote unquote, that the audience is giving you is not real or genuine or something that actually sustain you. I gotta say, I did not love this movie, and my kids peaced out halfway through. And we're like, I don't want to watch this anymore.
Wow.
I know.
Wow. That's yeah. bad, dude. That's
so
bad.
I literally watched the second half by myself. Yeah, just to be able to talk about it on the show.
Yeah,
I was like,
how often does that happen, by the way, where you start something with your show? I'm not talking about like general. I'm talking about like something that could conceivably be talked about on the show.
This is the first time that my kids were like, no. Usually, I mean, so it's usually a very difficult proposition to get my kids to sit down and watch a movie with me. And literally what I said this time and almost every time is, guys, you always love it. It's always great. You always are so happy that. And this time, both of my kids were like, Dad, I don't want to watch this anymore.
Wow.
And I was like, you know
what? The seal has been broken.
I kind of don't want to watch this anymore either. So I'm not going to force you to
do it. Quality. Yeah.
I think the movie looks really interesting. It's got kind of a lot of people are comparing it to Tim Burton stop motion stuff.
The poster looks great. Like the aesthetic looks really cool.
Yeah. And I mean, one of the odd things about it is that the monsters look like Monsters, Inc. monsters, which kind of baffles. Like, if you think that this guy is cobbling things together and creating what they call in this movie almost life, like the first one is a kid with stitches on his head, which is very, Frankenstein-esque. But everything else is like a Monsters, Inc. monster. It's like, well, where did you get those body parts from? Why does it look like a giant fur ball with – it's very odd. But one of the main monster characters that like tries to go save Stitchhead is cool because it has a big sort of, Sully from Monsters, Inc. shape and arms, but has a third – frail little human arm sticking out of its chest. And so I loved a lot of the animation of that, how they would use the third arm. I thought it was clever, but I have very little else to say positive about the movie. I mean, I think it's a competent movie in a lot of ways, but it just suffers from, I think, very poor pacing. It has musical numbers like you might expect from a Disney animated movie or a, classic kids animated movie. The first one, this is a 90-minute movie. The first musical number happens at minute 38.
Too late.
That's weird, right?
Yeah.
That's weird.
Well, I think we are living in an era of musicals being ashamed to be musicals. You know, like that's...
Yeah.
I think it is kids' movies.
Sure. You know?
Not kids'
movies.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. It's an oddly paced movie. Yeah, it's very melancholic and sort of, Stitchhead kind of talks like this and everything is a little bit, little Paddington, a little bit, everybody settled down. And like, it kind of just on the face of it, doesn't make sense that everybody's terrified of him because he looks like an adorable kid with some stitches in his head. And then they all love him. And it's none of it really holds together. And I think the pace is sort of glacier at the beginning. And even though there's these kinetic things that happen, it's all just sort of morose and plodding and kind of lugubrious. It's just a bummer because I think the concept is great and the look and feel of the world is fun, and there's some cool moments. They're just, I would say, few and far between, and it just conjures too many familiar things that are better than it. I'd rather watch Nightmare Before Christmas, I'd rather watch Monsters, Inc., and something that's kind of a mashup of those two but not as good as either one, just kind of falls flat for me, sadly.
Sounds like you should watch Hotel Transylvania, Jeff.
Yeah, I guess so.
With that. Yeah. I think you will certainly appreciate all the voice work in Hotel Transylvania, because like we don't see those people anymore or hear them, really. Mm.
All right.
That's Stitchhead, and it is out in theaters this week. All right. Devinder Hardwar, hit us up with something you watched this week.
Yeah, I saw the first episode of It, Welcome to Derry. I was not really looking forward to this, because as soon as like people started talking about the show, I was like, did we all just forget It Chapter 2? Did we forget what they did? Like how they like ruined that story and basically like that movie is barely watchable, I think. Like I was just really down on that movie. This is it's an It prequel set in the 60s, and I think it's fine. I think it reaches... There's something about It Chapter 2 that just felt like they didn't quite understand tension, right? The machetes, especially, they didn't understand how to build the tension. It felt like really overwrought. It didn't feel very humanistic or very realistic. This is an It show that delivers scary stuff, and the kids get harmed, and the It clown's around. That's it. That's really it. Like, I think it's perfectly fine. People who are less demanding of horror or of the mythology of Stephen King or anything, like, I think, like, they will probably be best served by it. I really liked the first It, and I certainly love the, like, original miniseries, too. So it's like, yeah, this is just not working for me. There are some sequences that are great. I think they try to go for something big at the end of the first episode, but I also feel like that's just, you're doing that because you have not many other tricks to pull right now. So I'm not sold on what they're selling with this show. What did you think of it, Dave?
I also only watched the first episode, and I guess I have two comments. First of all, many critics have seen more episodes. I've only seen episode one. Devinder's only seen episode one. Many critics were given five episodes. And based off of where people say the show is going, compared to what we also have learned from episode one, it sounds like it's going to be terrible. That's just something that I am guessing, right? Because let me throw this out there. Science fiction. Sci-fi. There's some sci-fi shit that's supposed to explain
that's
what's going on in It.
There is sci-fi
Tommyknockers?
Jeff, you know. There is sci-fi shit in the Stephen King averse.
Yes, yeah. But
and
not
it
the Tommyknockers, baby.
But not and in the It books as well, but not in the movies and not in the TV show.
I'm not opposed to going that way.
It
depends on how
to me, it seems like very not like this is a thing where the more you explain it, the less scary and interesting it gets, in my opinion. Right?
You kind of have to build the whole Stephen King universe, and for that, we needed like a well done Dark Tower series, right, or movie or something. Mm-hmm. We needed like the pieces in place so that when they built to cosmic horror, you need the Avengers of Stephen King stories, right, to really make this work. They're not. We've got bits and pieces, and right now we have the people who made half of a good It story trying to redo the magic of It, and I don't have no faith that they'll be able to do it well.
We're on the same page, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
I think ultimately first of all, the Stephen King universe stuff is cool. Okay, seeing the Halloran guy from The Shining, right? I think he's in here or someone related to him, and he's going to be in the show, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
And I saw in the trailer, there's a bus for the Shawshank prison. I'm like, oh, why Shawshank? There's a name I haven't heard in a long time.
I'm not just talking about references. I'm talking about like supreme evil. I'm talking about the roots of all like the stuff that is really percolating in Stephen King's head. We've never really explored that in the movies very well.
So that's one thought I have is like, the stuff the show has introduced, I don't particularly think is that interesting. And then the second thing is, I guess one of the reasons I really enjoyed both the It miniseries on TV and also the movie, the first one, as you said, Devinder, is I think it does a good job of capturing mundane suburban life. And then when that is disrupted, it's upsetting. This show, It, Welcome to Derry, starts at like a 12 out of 10. Like it does not ease you into it. And therefore, I actually found it to be not as scary as if it had kind of done a better job of establishing what the normal state of play is. All that said,
it's not scary. It's showy. Like they have set pieces, but not like thrills or the way you build it. Or
showy is a good word. Showy is that's the word I felt. I was like, this is very showy. You know, it's kind of how I felt watching this. So anyway, Devendra and I, not huge fans. That said, if you are a hardcore Stephen King fan, or you want to know what happened with the town that It was in 27 years before the events of It Part One, the Muschietti version, check out It Welcome to Derry, available right now on HBO Max.
That Castle Rock show was all right. They were doing some interesting stuff in Castle Rock. I forget if you saw that, Jeff, but I saw some of that. Yeah. It was all right. Better than this. Yeah.
Guys, do you have a guilty pleasure when it comes to YouTube? Like, is there something you watch on YouTube?
Yeah.
That's like a guilty pleasure. What's your
ASMR videos?
ASMR videos? Really?
I don't know if I call it a guilty pleasure.
Is there a specific type of ASMR, Jeff? Like, is it the person like blowing into the mic and tapping it?
No, I don't like their hair. Crap. I like whispery talk. I listen to the chess guy. I listen to the history guy. There's a girl I listen to.
I like how you're really condescending about or patronizing about the, you know, the hair ASMR.
It doesn't work.
I don't give a shit about that.
No, I hate the clickety clacks. The clickety clack. The brushing. I don't, none of that stuff works for me.
I need ASMR that mentally stimulates me. Right.
That's right.
Kind of.
I was just listening. I learned about Baccarat. Do you guys know how Baccarat is played?
No.
There's the ASMR guy who
Baccarat, you mean? The RAT?
Yeah, the Baccarat, whatever. Okay. Yes, the James Bond's.
Yeah, James Bond. Yeah, okay.
Yeah. Gotcha. Yeah.
Okay. Yep. We're going to go on a real quick tangent on this.
Okay, here we go.
This is fascinating to me.
Let's do it.
You asked me about YouTube.
I brought
videos.
This on ourselves. Let's go, Jeff. Yeah. Take us there.
I had always assumed Baccarat, whatever you want to call it, was, you know, because it was so intimately tied in my mind with James Bond, that it was a very high level strategic, he's going to go in there and he's going to James Bond it up. He's going to outsmart the Dr. No or whatever it is. You know, he's going to sit down at the Baccarat table and he's going to be so much better than everybody else because Baccarat is this high level strategy game. Wrong. Do you know how Baccarat is played? It's a 50-50 chance. It's this or that. Pick that pile or that pile based on no information. You have no information. You pick, you bet on this or that. And guess what? This happens or that happens. And that's the end. And you get money or don't. It's literally, there's no decision making other than what are you going to bet on before anything happens? And then the dealer like does some stuff and you find out. You have no influence at all in the outcome.
It really ticks the primal gambling brain, you know, that we all have.
I couldn't believe it. I was like, why would this make me think James Bond is cool?
Because there's nothing cool
about
doing it.
It's literally a complete chance, random chance that you're betting on. It's wild. Anyway, it's funny how class.
I will also just say, by the way,
as somebody who is pretty familiar with poker and how it works, if you watch Casino Royale, if you actually analyze the poker hand that he plays in Casino Royale, it's similarly nonsensical.
But no. But you're not hearing my point. Is he's making decisions when he plays poker?
Sure. Yeah.
The nonsensicalness of how they play out is all movies do poker weird, right?
Where everybody
has the best. You know, the end of Maverick when everybody has the best hand you could possibly have.
It's nonsense.
That's not what I'm talking about.
Yeah, okay,
I'm talking about the level of decision making, which is zero in Baccarat. You make decision. You literally bet on this or that, and that's you're done. You're done making decisions, and you have no information when you start the betting process as to which this or that has an advantage. You're just wildly guessing.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, that's an ASMR video I watched.
Wow.
Yeah.
Devendra Hardar, guilty YouTube pleasure. Devendra, you don't believe in guilty pleasures, is what right?
Like, it's just
pleasures.
Be proud. Be proud of the thing that gives
you joy.
Be proud
of the thing you enjoy. Yeah.
So
do you have any guilty
something? If I'm like writing or just bored, or I need to like focus on something. I like the videos that just like strolls through foreign cities. I miss the sounds of cities.
Cool.
So like people walking through Tokyo and stuff. Like
that's so cool.
I miss the sounds of a city. So I like hearing.
Have you done that, Devendra? I do that frequently in VR.
Yeah,
there's the a VR lot stuff is of cool great too. VR, just like put you on the street in Dubai or wherever. It's cool.
You know, every time I ask this question, it's always like so fascinating and revealing. Like we had at my birthday dinner, the similar question came up. I was like, what's like on your YouTube algo? You know, like what gets served up to you? And everyone's is very different. And it's always like revealing about them in some way. So
that's why YouTube is such a magical service because literally everything is there.
The best and the worst. Yeah.
Yeah.
And everything in between.
Yep.
Well, so you
find
something
to for push your you niche. To the worst.
On that note, my guilty pleasure is police body cam videos, guys.
Wow.
I've been watching a lot.
A little darker.
I've been watching a lot of
police. You could be learning about Baccarat right now.
I've been watching a lot of police body cam videos, and some of these channels are really horrible and exploitative and...
Yeah, you found the one that's not good. The not feel good. Like Jeff wants little sounds in his brain. Yeah. I want the simple sounds of a city. You're like,
call
look at those pigs.
Yeah.
Look at those pigs breaking the law again.
Well, so some of the channels are like really horrifying and disgusting, and some of them are actually informative and interesting and entertaining. And you know, putting aside your feelings on American police in general, right?
it's the stand-up comic cop. It's like it's the entertaining one. I got to tune into this guy. He's so good out on his beat, like popping one-liners.
Anyway, I bring that up because when I heard about this movie, I was very intrigued, and I might have talked about this a little bit earlier this year when I saw it at Sundance, or Sundance Online, but this movie was acquired by Netflix and is now on Netflix. It's called The Perfect Neighbor, and at the beginning of the film, you see text on screen that says, "This film primarily consists of police body cam footage that was taken over the course of 2 years."
Yeah, you were just like rubbing your hands. I'm like, finally.
And that is what it is. And look, I don't want to make too many jokes about this because I don't think this is a huge mystery. Something bad happens during the course of the movie.
Oh.
Like it's an upsetting sequence of events occurs, right? And that's why you're watching this movie. And I actually just think it's a really effectively done movie. Apparently it was made with the participation of some of the people that were impacted by the events of the movie, and just presents like this really upsetting, quintessentially American sequence of events. Like, I don't think anything like this would happen in another country for reasons that I'm not going to get into. But it is really upsetting and it is very revealing. And I do think it is very instructive. It's also, of course, deeply upsetting. So, like, if you don't want to be upset by things, you should not watch this movie. But there is something about the way that this movie assembles all the footage together that I do think is very skillful. And it kind of it makes clear from the beginning. It doesn't. You know how some movies? There's a movie I watched actually. I don't even know if I want to reveal it, but. There was a movie I watched like not too long ago where one of the main, it's a documentary. So The Perfect Neighbor is also a documentary, but one of the main people in the documentary dies during the course of the documentary. Now, I'm not talking about this movie. I'm talking about another movie. And the movie saves that reveal for like a spoiler, it saves it as like a big reveal. Like, aha, twist, that person's dead. And I just thought that was very like, in poor taste and poorly done. I will just say that this movie handles whatever occurs in this movie, I think, with a great deal of sensitivity. It is still very upsetting. It is still very troubling. But I do think it teaches you something about how police works, how police function in America. It teaches you something about how the laws work. It teaches you something about how people try and fail to relate to each other in America these days. And so I do think it's worth watching. So that's The Perfect Neighbor. And it's available on Netflix. It's one
Dave,
thing
Dave, do you just like, when we're doing like YouTube stuff, do you just have like an upsetting dial, right? And you just like keep turning it until it hits the perfect amount of upsetting content for you?
Yeah.
How did you find police body cam videos?
Turning Why? A big dial that says upsetting on
yeah,
it.
Yeah, exactly.
And constantly looking back at the audience for approval, like a contestant on The Price is
Right. Your poor wife.
Yeah, she often says like she knows that I'm watching because she's like I start hearing screaming coming from the other room on off of David's phone, and so I know it's time for the police body cam footage. Anyway,
when Dave needs a respite from the horrible movies he's watching, just head over to YouTube, baby.
It's like okay, House of Dynamite was upsetting. But it wasn't actually something that happened in real life. So I need something that checks both boxes. We'll take one more final break for a sponsor. We'll be back with a little bit more of what we'll be watching right after this. All right, Devendra Hardwar, bring us home.
Yeah, bring us home. I've been watching Splinter Cell Death Watch, the new animated Splinter Cell show that's on Netflix. And I've been excited about this for a couple of reasons. First of all, Derek Kolstad created this, so got the John Wick guys in there. I also really like Splinter Cell. What happened to that franchise? I feel like Ubisoft, Jeff, I don't know if you have feelings about this, but Ubisoft as a company just like totally gave up on Splinter Cell as they've been chasing the sort of like, you know, multiplayer money generation dream thing.
It's weird. Yeah.
It's really weird.
And I was there hoping were this some... show might be sort of them testing the waters yes. for a game, yes. but no.
For sure. I mean, and the show does, it is a reboot in many ways, right? We've got Liev Schreiber as the voice of Sam Fisher. I love Liev Schreiber going into his like voice acting mode because him as Kingpin in Spider-Verse, like that was good stuff. He has a good deep voice for voice acting. So that's cool. Kirby Hal-Baptiste stars as like a new secret agent. I don't know, Splinter Cell agent. Janet Varney does some voices or does a voice here too. She's from Legend of Korra and a whole bunch of stuff. So I love the voice work. I think it's pretty well written. Derek Kolstad wrote most of the episodes from what I can tell. At least wrote like five or six of them. And it has like good action, as you'd expect from the creator of John Wick. He didn't direct these episodes. Let me see here. I see French names as director. Yeah. Guillaume Dos, one of the major directors. But like there's a good sense of action. I like how the choreography goes. So it's like it is the Splinter Cell universe. You've got the cool like triple eye camera. You've got spies going around doing spy shit, and it's cool. Like if I still wouldn't call it a guilty pleasure. Just call it pleasure. This is cool action stuff, spy thriller stuff. There's a conspiracy. There's stuff happening. It's engaging enough to make me keep watching. But the reason I'm watching is because all the setups. The action is just really well done. And Liev Schreiber is just like really leaning into this role. So I'm digging it. And I hope like companies are less afraid of making like, I don't know, single player games again. It's kind of the sad thing right now. But yeah, I'm liking Splinter Cell Death Watch.
I've heard great things about this. Great action. It's on Netflix. Splinter Cell Death Watch is something else mm-hmm. Devendra Hardwar has been watching. All right, folks. That's the end of what we'll be watching. Let's get to some weekly plugs. Weekly plugs is a part of the show each week where we plug something else we've been making. Well, I've been hinting very vaguely at a big trip I'm going to be making. And if you want to learn more details about that, sign up at a new newsletter that I've launched called DaveChenTravels.com. You can find it there, DaveChenTravels.com. You know, I've been saying the words DaveChenTravels.com very frequently to like my friends and family and such.
Uh-huh.
And I think people didn't understand that it's a you have to subscribe to it. Like people are just like, what? Okay, I go. What do I do? It's an email list. You got to subscribe to it. So DaveChenTravels.com. If you want to get a new email every time I make a new video, which I'm planning to do very frequently on this next journey that I'll be on. So be sure to check out DaveChenTravels.com and subscribe.
Signing up right now.
Thank you. Devendra Hardwar, your weekly plug.
Yeah, check out the Engadget podcast. We had a good conversation about AI video and kind of the state of where we're at with Drew Howell from The Washington Post and also Jeremy Caresco, who makes videos on TikTok and elsewhere deconstructing AI videos, like trying to tell you why something is AI. And I think we had a really good discussion about how dangerous things are right now, like with Sora 2 and the Sora app. How unprepared we are as a society and kind of like just what this means for the way we think about truth and the way our reality is going to be shaped by these videos. So we had a good conversation. Check that episode out.
I want to tell you guys a story. You know, we're reviewing a movie called Good Fortune today that has a lot of angels in it. And it reminds me of this story where God once spoke to his angels and he said, after extensive trials, I have figured out a way to rotate a planet so it receives an even distribution of sunlight and evening. After extensive trials, I figured out a way to rotate a planet so it receives an even distribution of sunlight and evening.
Hmm.
Anyway, Jeff Cannata, what is your weekly plug?
Limericks, available to you at cameo.com/Jeff Cannata. I will write one to your specifications, deliver it to you via video. And it brings delight to all. Check out the 5-star reviews over there at cameo.com/Jeff Cannata if you don't believe me. There's a lot of them. People seem to really enjoy it, and I enjoy it too. So check it out, cameo.com/Jeff Cannata.
Patreon.com/filmpodcast is where you can support this show, get ad-free episodes, exclusive After Darks, like the one where Devendra and I are going to discuss the ending of House of Dynamite, and early access episodes whenever we are able to do that. Patreon.com/filmpodcast. Of course, we never want you to donate if it in any way causes you financial hardship. You can always support us for free by leaving a review for us, reviewing our podcast, as you know, our listener earlier wrote in, like reviewing an episode for us. That'd be great. Wherever you get your podcast, we really appreciate it. Thanks to everyone who helps to keep the show going in some way. Let's get to our review of Good Fortune.
Martha?
Yes, Gabriel.
Is there any way I can have more meaningful duties? I want to guide people. I want to change their lives.
To save a lost soul, you have to find a lost soul.
Hey, Arch! Don't forget your pee bottle, bro!
A lost soul. Arch, I'm an angel. My name is Gabriel. I'm here to save you.
What? Who the fuck are you? How do you know my name?
I'm normally only in charge of saving people from texting and driving.
Wait, you're telling me I have a budget guardian angel?
Kinda.
So then the angel says back to God, "Wow, what are you gonna do now, sir?" And God said, "Call it a day."
Wow. Wow.
Welcome to the Filmcast review of Good Fortune. I'm going to read the plot summary of this movie from the internet. A well-meaning but inept angel named Gabriel meddles in the lives of a struggling gig worker and a wealthy venture capitalist, end quote. Devendra Hardwar, what are your thoughts on Good Fortune?
My thoughts on Good Fortune are that it really, wow, I miss Aziz Ansari writing sweet comedy. Like, just really good-hearted comedy, making fully formed characters who feel interesting, and also he has something to say. This movie reminds me a lot of Master of None, his Netflix show, which covered a lot of ground. I feel like not many people saw the final season, and the final season was some incredible stuff.
Extraordinary. I think it's one of the... Yeah. The final season was very different and obviously came after some amount of controversy that occurred.
Yeah.
But I thought the final season is one of the most impactful works of art I have ever seen, like, in my life. I would say Master of None season 3 was extraordinary. And so
that was more of a dramedy series that had some comedy in it. But Aziz has a knack for writing, like, just sweet, kind characters and funny situations. And I think Good Fortune has a lot of good stuff in it. I feel like, man, I was waiting for him to make a great comeback with this and everything. Then the Riyadh Comedy Festival happened. I'm like, man, buddy... I was just getting ready to love you fully again, you know, really bring you back into things. I think the message of this movie is so, so great. It comes from the perspective that is very worker and labor centric. And, like, you know, Aziz is somebody who has reached a certain amount of success, but also clearly remembers what life was like to, like, struggle to get there. And this is told from the perspective of gig workers and people working in retail and people trying to organize unions, and how, like, that there's we live in a society that just does not really support that, right? It's just really hard to exist and hard to live if you don't make much money. And also how the society is, like, weirdly weighted towards, you know, yeah, if you're rich, like, you get stuff. You get stuff for free when the people who barely have money don't. So I think there's a lot of great perspective in this, and I think it's genuinely funny and genuinely sweet. And I really liked it. It is also kind of amazing this is a thing that's in theaters, because we're not seeing, like, just straight up comedies that aren't, like, specifically genre focused. Like, it's not just, like, rom-com adjacent or something. It's just a sweet story about a guy and he's dealing with angels. And I hope we get more stuff like this from Aziz. Nice to see Keanu in a like comedy role too. He's popped up in like a couple of movies. He's popped up in a rom-com, but it's cool to see him just like showing up in different things. I really enjoyed this.
And I would say this, this role plays to his strengths. You know, some seen movies that I think really use Keanu very well and some movies that use him poorly. He is a very specific set of skills, a very specific demeanor. And I do think that this movie makes good use of him. I am really curious, Jeff Cannata, what do you think about Good Fortune?
Well, Dave, I guess you could say what I thought about Good Fortune is best summed up in the form of a limerick. A gig worker is feeling so sunk he gets a chance to make his boss the flunky. Hanging out with Aziz, Seth Rogen, and Reeves is fun, but the plot is so clunky.
Wow. I mean, I'm sorry you didn't like the movie that much, Jeff, but also, what did you rhyme sunk he with clunky? And what was the other one?
Flunky.
What did you say?
Flunky. His boss the flunky.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. I mean, Jeff, that's, I'm not being sarcastic. That's next level stuff.
Yeah.
Level rhyme. Sunky and flunky. Like, flunky is not even a common word. You know what I mean? But it's accurate. So well done, Jeff. Well done.
Thank you. I wouldn't say that I disliked this movie at all. I thought it was fine. I think Devendra arrived on the perfect word. It is sweet. It's a sweet little movie. Mm-hmm. And I had a perfectly fine time watching it. Like I said, these three main actors are all so charming and can't help but be charming. And you're right. Keanu is such an odd bird. He's just such an odd presence. And his like weird kind of staccato delivery is so odd, but it kind of works as a angel. You know, it's like, he's not a human being. He's like an alien sent down here to be an actor. It's weird.
I really wish I could see Waiting for Godot is happening.
I know.
It's like, oh, man,
my wife and I have talked about literally flying to New York for that. We just can't get sitters for the kids. It's also the first time I've seen him look old in anything, you know, which I thought was interesting.
Well, in the documentary, Wick is Pain, right? Mm. I mean, how old is he? It's like 60, right? He's getting on in years. And so in Wick is Pain, I was like, it was the first time where I was like, maybe this guy can't keep making these John Wick movies. Right? Like that was kind of the maybe first time done. That I felt that.
They should probably kill him off.
Yeah.
They'll
get right on that.
The movie is lovely. And I think has some delightful parts. I do think it's very clunky. I do think it really shoehorns things in the way it explains things. I mean, I love, you guys know me. I love magic and magical parts of, otherwise grounded movies. That is one of my favorite things in a specific, like a romantic comedy or a light comedy, is to have a sprinkle of magic. You know, L.A. Story is such a great example, or Defending Your Life or something like that, like movies that have this sort of fantastical element to it. So I loved all the angel-y stuff and the rules of the angel-y stuff and how, you know, all that stuff where I thought that was great. That's not what I'm talking about with the clunky sort of shoehorning in. It's like explaining certain things away with a hand wave, or, you know, like forcing Seth Rogen into the situation that he didn't need to be in at all. Like it's a very odd, I don't know how, we could probably talk about it in spoilers, but you know, Seth Rogen, there are three main storylines in this movie. Mm-hmm. Every one of those actors gets a full storyline, a full arc. And I think the movie is just trying to do too much with its short running time. Like we have a whole Keanu Reeves thing going on. We have a whole Seth Rogen thing going on. And while those are happening, you know, Aziz is just like off stage completely. And then we have a whole Aziz thing going on. And I don't think any one of them, you know, is fully fleshed out in the way you might if that was the whole movie, you know? And so we sort of shorthand a lot of things, and it ends up, to my mind, feeling clunky. It feels like, oh, we didn't have really the time to explain this, so we'll just say it happened, and we'll just, you just have to suspend your disbelief and like, oh, okay, you guys are now hanging out together because we want you to. There's no real reason for Keanu's like, should we hang out? And they're like, yeah, let's hang out. It's like there's no There's no reason for that. It's just we're just going to force it into the script. And I felt like that happens quite frequently in the movie, to the point where I was like, well, this isn't a home run for me. This isn't a movie I'm going to scream from the mountaintops and be like, oh, I love this film, which I do for Master of None, for example, you know. But I do think the movie is sweet, as Devendra said, and charming, and has a lot of lovely things. I think the message, while it is one that I thoroughly align with ideologically, I feel is a little heavy-handed, especially at the end where Seth Rogen is like speechifying.
Oh, yeah, okay, yep.
You know, I think it is a flawed film for me. Not a home run, but I do. It is one I would recommend if you want a sweet, lovely time at the movies. Maybe a date night, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll just say I loved this film, and I'm actually stunned that Jeff didn't love it, because when I saw it, I thought, man, I feel like Jeff's gonna love this one. You know, I don't know you, Jeff. That's kind of, I think, what we've learned over the course of the last few weeks. Because here's why. Because I thought it was very similar thematically in some ways to Dark Matter, which is a show that mm-hmm. you and I both loved mm-hmm. on Apple TV Plus.
Wow, that's a weird comparison.
I know that this show, this movie, Good Fortune, probably has a lot more in common with movies like Trading Places and It's a Wonderful Life, you know? Mm-hmm. But in my mind, right, I mean, I do not believe it is a spoiler to say that one of the big themes of the movie is developing an appreciation of what you have in your own life. And when you see it from an alternate point of view, it may allow you to have access to that in a way that you didn't before. And I really got that. You know, I'm definitely, now I'll just acknowledge, I'm definitely in a part of my life where I am reevaluating a lot of things, let's say. And so this kind of hit me at a very sensitive time where I'm like, oh, you know, a lot of this movie is focused on having gratitude for, you know, what your current situation is, and altering your perspective on what your current situation is. And I really just appreciated those things greatly. We've already talked about the performances. I thought they're all really strong and appropriately geared for what this movie is trying to do. I also got to say, I think the script is actually great. I think that there is a lot of setup and payoff throughout the script that is very satisfying. It doesn't just feel like all these people got together and kind of improvised the way through this. It feels like, oh, there's like a very mm-hmm. deliberate plan for this that to me felt satisfying by the end. So I may have a handful of issues with the film. I do think that it is very unfortunate that this movie is one of the few films I've seen this year in theaters that has a really pretty strong social justice message.
Yeah.
And also, the writer director of it just performed at the Riyadh Comedy Festival. Obviously, he has his own justification for doing that, but it's been very controversial. And presumably, he was paid very well for that. And so it's just like, it's hard to then square that with kind of this movie and the message of it. I will say that.
He said he'll donate some money to human rights groups, right, which is, you know, a start. But it's like, I don't think he, and I think a lot of people, did not ever fully engage with the criticism of like why it was a problem going there.
Exactly.
But I will say good things about this movie. There's a lot of people sleeping in cars in real life now. Like, the economy is hitting people hard. And this is a movie where it's like, yeah, a guy is sleeping in his car because that's just kind of the way he has to survive right now. And he is struggling. He's doing gig work. He's doing a lot of random stuff. The systems that they exist in are inherently unfair. Somebody can give you a bad review, even if something happens that's not your fault, and then all of a sudden your livelihood is hit. A robot can come and like take away part of your job, or a company can lay you off saying AI is going to do it instead. We have built these systems that are so inherently unfair and pushing people to such like a desperate breaking point. As we're recording this, we're waiting for SNAP funding to end in America. People are going to go hungry. Hundreds of thousands, millions of people are going to go hungry in this country because we have an administration that just doesn't care enough to fix any of these problems. But also, these problems exist because this is our society.
Yeah.
This is our society that we're living in. And at least like this movie is aware of that fact. And I have not seen too many things like engage in the fact that, yeah, we are living
absolutely
in a desperate economic times right now.
It's tough because I think there's an inherent tension because most of the people that make movies are millionaires, right?
Yes.
Most of the people that make, and so it's like, it's hard for them to make
a movie.
Most
of the people
about,
that star in movies.
Yes.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, you're right. Yeah. And correct. Very good, Jeff. Very, most of the people that appear on screen in movies.
No, I wouldn't even say that. I think most of the people that are above the line, the stars in movies.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. That's what I'm trying to say. So, yes. And, but yeah, a good point. Most people who quote unquote make movies like are behind the scenes. And they are not millionaires, but the stars are, and so then it's generally like a challenge to like square that with kind of a social justice message. But I think this movie does a relatively good job of it, and I appreciated that. So, and I love the ending. I honestly wept at the ending of this film because I was
We'll talk. We can talk about that in spoilers.
But I was very moved by it. I was very moved by it. So because
it's like a thing I wish would happen, but I know too much. About how things work. I'm like, oh,
we can talk about it in spoilers, but that's another thing that just kind of rang a little hollow for me is that, and I know that's what Hollywood does, right? It wants to give you the beautiful, idealistic version. I think that it rang hollow for me and didn't feel earned. It felt a little pat.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's talk about it.
Before we get to spoilers, shout out to Kiki Palmer, who is great in this.
She's great.
Wonderful.
She is fantastic. Yeah.
Wonderful.
Tons to do, but what she does is good.
She has motive. She has an arc of her own too. Yeah.
Spoilers for Good Fortune starting right now.
I thought up an ending for my book.
It makes no damn sense.
Compels me, though.
I didn't come here to tell you how this is going to end.
When I buy a new book, I always read the last page first. That way, in case I die before I finish, I know how it ends.
You can't handle the truth!
Inconceivable!
I came here to tell you how it's going to begin.
I mean, I will say that I do think the movie's trying to do a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the Seth Rogen plotline is one that is probably the least, the Keanu plotline is very small. Like it's not he doesn't have a huge arc, but I do think like trying to shoehorn the whole AI thing into this is a little bit much. Here's what I've learned this year, guys. Seth Rogen really hates AI. That's he was also in the studio. He also had a huge, there was like a whole episode dedicated to hating on AI. And I think
you watched Platonic?
As a prominent creator. That's
no,
a good thing
is it also in that as well?
Platonic, every time his character sees a robot, one of those robot Amazon delivery things, he kicks it. Mm. And it's this, it happens almost every episode where he'll see one on the street and he'll run over and kick it and try to knock it over.
Yeah.
Like, I think this is,
I wonder if that's Apple tapping incidental. Him on the shoulder. More of that. More.
Yeah.
Kick it harder. Yeah.
So he gives a big speech at the end, and Jeff, you were unmoved by it.
No, I thought it was a fine movie moment. I thought it rang hollow that experience would change that guy and that you know, we can pay our work. And it's like, yes, okay, I love it. But I am perhaps a little too cynical.
You're jaded. I mean, it is possible for people to run companies in a humane way. None of them come to mind right now. Really.
Just no examples of it. I mean, but in the abstract.
No, but I think it has happened. I think it's possible. But you're right. There's not that many examples of it. And
it's really not in America. Like it's happening more elsewhere where there are support structures in a society to support things like healthcare and other aspects of your life. In America, it's real hard. It's real hard to guarantee any of those things.
I understand why your reaction is, oh, wow, the issues are far more systemic than that. And just because one guy has a change of heart doesn't mean everything's going to be solved. Like, I get that in theory. And also part of me does believe that it is possible for people to, like, try to be good and create a humane workplace and, you know, make a difference in the world, you know? So I was not let me put it this way, Jeff. There's like 70 to 80% of me that feels the same way you do about, like, well, that's not going to solve anything. But then part of me is like, you know what? Maybe it might. And that's where I ended up, if it were more earned,
the thing, like I like this movie quite a bit. I just feel like that ending speech just didn't quite land.
I agree.
We see him have some experiences. We see him experience some struggle now and see how hard life is now because he's lived kind of in a bubble of privilege since just making quick money in the tech world. But there's not much learning, I guess. Like there's not much like, oh, this is kind of why it's so bad. One guy doing a good thing to save his company, I'm not going to turn that down, you know, or to like treat people better. That's not going to solve everything, but it didn't, his specific thing to make the company work better didn't feel as earned as it could be. But this is a short movie. Also, throwback to movies that are almost 90 minutes long, right? So yeah, they didn't have much room to work with. This movie is cooking. It's moving. Like, I do kind of miss that of, you know, comedies that just like didn't really waste any time. So you get to a big ending. We didn't have time to really build into it, and I wish we did. That's the thing. But otherwise, the pacing of this movie, like, I guess it would kind of hurt that too.
Well, there's a lot of, I agree with everything you just said, Devendra, so I won't even add on to it. I'll just underscore that. But there's other moments too, where, you know, it's like, what I like about this movie a lot is that it's sort of a postmodern It's a Wonderful Life, you know, where it's like, hey, you know, the Keanu's angel perspective is the Wits of Wonderful Life perspective. And this is like, no, man, show me the other half. And this is awesome. I liked the flipping the expectation on its head of Aziz getting, you know, Seth Rogen's life and realizing this is great. Why would I ever want to go back? But, it felt a little contrived getting Seth Rogen into the other perspective. Cause like,
right,
Aziz never feels like the kind of guy who's going to be like, go fuck yourself.
Yeah.
Figure it out. You know, he's going to be like, yeah, okay, we made this deal. You know, Seth Rogen is being so magnanimous and being like, yeah, okay, keep my life for a little while. I feel like the obvious next step is Aziz going, yeah, just stay in the side house or whatever. You know, like, you know, there's plenty of rooms in here. You can stay. Like, there's the idea that he would kick him out completely and now they have to go gig economy on their own felt so shoehorned on into the narrative. It just felt like, well, I don't buy that's the next step. And then Keanu going, well, can I hang out with you? It's like, oh, you want to hang out with the most uncomfortable of the situations, the guy who's having the hardest time of it? Like, that I would love for all of that to have just been motivated more organically and not feel like, hey, we are moving along at a zip here. We are keeping this at 90 minutes. So just yada, 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 the explanation, and just go with this. Cause you know, that's the situation we want to get to. We want to get to our trading places.
Maybe he just knew his angel influence was more needed with the Seth Rogen character than the Aziz character. Because one of the most refreshing things about this movie is that, having money to solve basic needs, like, oh, then a lot of the problems of your life do go away when you can afford a place to live and like get food and like you don't have to think about like struggling to survive on a day-to-day basis. I think that's the smartest part of this movie, is that recognition of just like, you can say, you know, it's important to live a better life, but also people need to survive. People need to eat. People need a place to sleep.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed all the ways it played with the formula, right? Yeah. So, as you said, Jeff, like, all the stuff when Keanu is trying to convince him, hey, like, we're gonna look into your future a little bit.
Yeah.
And then he puts his hand on his shoulder, and like, that sequence I thought was so beautifully done with the match cuts and and then seeing like these, and the verses of his future aren't horrible. They're not like nightmarish.
Yeah.
But they're just really uninspiring. And I love that it hit this really narrow target of, it's not like a nightmare. It's not like horrible. It's just like, oh, that's not aspirational at all.
Yeah, it doesn't make me want to go back to that.
Right. Like, exactly. There's nothing like, this is not like, people have worse lives than this. But it's not like this is going to motivate me to keep on going, you know, the hope of this.
Right.
And I thought that sequence was so well done. And then when Keanu is trying to convince him that his life is worse now in the VC's person's life, when he says, oh, wow, you know, hey, you have a pool expense. It's $10,000. He's like, wow, not so easy to have a pool, is it? And then he's like, no, it's completely fine. Right. And I thought that was very.
Oh, you got to go do work. You've never prepared to work as a VC. I love that meeting.
The meeting.
I've been in those meetings.
2 minutes of work.
And like, all those right, people.
We're all done. Let's drink.
That was all very good. And and it's just really well done, because we have, like you said, postmodern. We have in our minds what that scene is, and then to subvert it in such a way, I thought was really brilliant. Mm-hmm. And then I love quote unquote twist at the end, where Arj not only has to be willing to trade places back, he has to actually want to.
Yeah.
That I thought was just really cool. And when Seth Rogen reacts to that, that was like one of the funniest moments for me. He's like, wait, you're telling me like he has to not only be willing, which by the way, I thought was a very, you know, difficult target already. Mm-hmm. But he has to actually want, he's like, there's no way this is going to happen. And I really appreciated that.
This movie has a lot of real moments. Arch talking to the kid. Kid's like, I want to be
that
a geologist.
Great. Oh, yeah. That was
you know
so
how many
good.
Geologists I've met in my life. This is the trajectory of your life. And yeah, we're all getting older now. So it's like, yeah, that's when people ask me for advice, it's like, how do I get into journalism, buddy?
And then the payoff where he gets the bad review. It's like said dark shit to my kid. It's like, I thought that was great.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. There's a lot of that like setup payoff I found throughout the film that was very enjoyable.
But also, genuinely real perspective of like, we have been sold a lie. I don't know. Like the things we all heard going to school. Yeah, go to college. Get good grades. You'll be set for life. Meanwhile, the actual like the things that underpin those jobs or our economy crumbling, absolutely crumbling, because people are just trying to yank as much profit out as they can without building like a sustainable society. So, you know, we have been lied to.
The part of the movie that really moved me was when Arj actually comes to that realization at the end of the film. I honestly wish there had been a little bit more of that, because he says things like, hey, I like he has this big party at the end, and then his character's dad is there. And also, I believe it's Aziz's real life dad.
It's Aziz's dad.
And he says, oh, I invited my dad to the party. But in this universe, he's a stranger to me. And I'm like, wait, so in the switched universe, like, you have a different family? Like, what even
that's weird.
Is this? And
Seth Rogen's family.
That's, I guess, right? Mm-hmm. How does that all work? Like, that's never explored. Yeah. Anyway, but I think that that's actually, if you're like, hey, what's a reason you wouldn't want to switch lives with a really rich person that's successful? That's one of the reasons, is like your friends, the people you know, your friends and family, like the people you care about.
Yeah, and I think it didn't make enough of a deal about that.
Yeah,
in my opinion.
Exactly. Yeah. Like, because it hints at that. Like the Kiki Palmer character is really the stand in for that idea.
Right. But even that is not, I don't think lands the plane exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I wish there had been a little bit more, because it's like, oh, there's all these experiences we wish you'd had. But that said, I do think fundamentally the idea is profound, right? Is that like, this movie, like the best type of its ilk, like It's a Wonderful Life, in my opinion, does make you reflect on the state of your life and what are the things you're thankful for. And how, like, yes, you could trade a bunch of things, but then it wouldn't be your life. It would be a different person's life, and it would be fundamentally different, and therefore perhaps not something you would want in that situation. I also just gotta say, I really love the ending, the final shot of the film. Very Inception-esque, very like the top spinning, and then like smash cut to black.
Very Inception-esque.
Like, well, and at the end of Inception, like
there's no mystery on this one.
Okay,
I like
fair.
The shot.
That's right.
I like the shot. The whole point of the Inception shot is mystery.
That's true.
Open mystery.
I just mean like,
and then
something
the angel
happens right
ate
at the
taco.
Right at the last second, and then it cuts to black. Like that's what I mean when I say
the angel eat the taco. We will never know.
Yeah.
Can angels eat tacos?
Okay, fair enough.
It's actually true. We don't know if the angel can eat the taco.
Who knows? Maybe it just falls down afterwards because you can't eat it. But I did like that. It's like, oh, it's kind of if you're not paying attention, you miss it. And then it's over. The movie's over. And that's what I like about it. I agree that in many ways it is different than Inception. I like the movie a lot, and Jeff, I'm
more
sorry.
Comedies,
you
more comedies,
like
in
no, more comedies
in theaters.
No, I don't want you to frame it like I didn't like it. Okay. I had a pleasant time watching this movie. I just thought it.
That's fair.
Its potential was greater than it achieved, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
It also feels weird being like nice, pleasant comedy that is not like a specific genre.
Yeah,
in a theater.
Isn't this a gross-out comedy?
I'm also going to say this. That has an actual plot. That's not just like, hey, we're all just riffing and improvising. Like
high concept.
High concept, right.
Yeah.
It's rare, and we should support them when we can. So, anyway, I'm glad you guys liked the movie to the extent that you did. And at the end of the day, it is impressive that Aziz Ansari made a movie. And that's going to bring us to the end of this week's episode of The Filmcast. You can find more episodes of the show at thefilmcast.com. Email us at /filmcast@gmail.com. Our theme song comes from Tim McEwen from The Midnight. Check out their new album, Syndicate. Our spoiler bumper and weekly plugs music comes from Noah Ross, who also edited this episode. Video assistance provided by Kurt Mega and John Barry. Next week on the podcast, Begonia, the new Yorgos. Going to be our main
cranking
review.
Them out, Yorgos.
Absolutely. Amazing. You love to see it. I just love, this is like Scorsese and DiCaprio kind of pairing, right? Like,
yeah.
Yorgos and Emma Stone. I love it. They're doing great work together. They're crushing
awesome. She's great.
She's amazing. Amazing. Mm-hmm. So I'm super psyched about this one. So Begonia is going to be the main review next week. Until then, thank you so much for listening. And we'll see you later. Goodbye.